Today is June 7th, 2022, and this is a journey through history. And tonight we've got a guest host or guest facilitator, Ms. Kathy Snyder, leading us in the discussion of the book, The Daughters of Yalta. And it's got a bunch of other subtitles after, but I'll let Kathy fill in those blanks because I don't remember them all. But we normally have a recording to play, but I think we've run into some technical difficulties getting that sorted. So we're just going to do things the old-fashioned way and talk through the books and stuff and let Kathy direct us. So, Kathy, why don't you take us away? And if you want me to call on people, I'll be happy to do it. I assume you know how to do that. So if you need my help, just let me know. Otherwise, you can rock and roll.
Okay, thanks, Alan. Well, I only have the book as titled The Daughters of Yalta from the author's website, so...
Okay. All right.
It may have more on it, but shoot, I didn't write it down either.
Okay.
But I thought maybe I'd start real quick and tell you a little bit about the author because this is her first book, believe it or not. I thought that was astounding. And her name is Catherine Grace Katz, and she's a writer and historian who lives in Chicago. So let's see. She has a BA from Harvard. A BA in history, and then has a master's in philosophy in modern European history from Christ College, University of Cambridge. And then I think in the book, it said in the back, she's pursuing her JD at Harvard Law School. So I thought this was just an excellent first book, you know. And obviously she knows her history and enjoys history because she went into a lot of details on this. And in the back of the book where she wrote her thank yous and stuff, she said that Randolph Churchill, who was probably a grandchild of Winston Churchill or maybe a great grandchild, but he encouraged her to write this book, and also that the Roosevelt family helped her by allowing her to read their private letters and stuff. So she obviously had a lot of confidence in her by, you know, encouraging her and allowing her. So, we're doing this the old-fashioned way, and I'll just kind of go over briefly over who the characters were, and then we'll just go around the room. There was the Churchills, which was Winston and his daughter, Sarah. There were the Roosevelts, which was Franklin and his daughter, Anna. And it's said in the book that Anna was chosen by Eleanor Roosevelt. She didn't want to go or couldn't go. And so Eleanor picked Anna, who actually had a family and kids, to go to help the president. And then there were the Harrimans, which was Averell Harriman and his daughter Kathleen. And he was the U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union at that time. And then of course there was Stalin. And his daughter really wasn't involved too much in the book. They didn't really talk about it. And apparently she kind of had a hard life with him as her father. So that's the backdrop. They were, it was at the end of the World War II and at the Yalta conference. And so I'll call on y'all and we'll go around and you can say whatever you liked the book or you didn't like it and maybe what you liked about it. But Mary Ellen, you want to go first?
I absolutely. It's one of the greatest. I'm just crazy about this book because we did a great deal of, we did a very little discussion of this period of history when I studied history at university. And I remember the most we heard about Yalta was somebody's, you know, 5-page report in class. And so anything I can learn about this time of period, and, you know, because it's kind of getting into the time I started living, I always want to know. And I love England and was there 14 years ago and got to see the damage that that war did to the cathedral in Coventry. And so it just brought a lot of that back, a lot of those memories. And I will be quiet or I'll take up the rest of the time going on about it. But it was one of the best books I've read in a very long time.
Okay, great. That's how I felt about it too. All right, Lynn, do you want to go next? Well, she's on mute. Okay. Alan, you want to go next?
Yeah, I'll go next. I'm not going to gush quite as much as Mary Ellen did, but I enjoy the book. I got through it all. I just, I realized we gave Stalin, Stalin had, because he was Stalin and was a little bent anyway, I think. But I think they kowtowed a little too much to him. Now, you know, I know a lot of Russians got killed during World War II. I think that the estimates that my echo said, they said nobody knows for sure how many, but it's been estimated as high as 20 million. I don't know how many of those the Germans killed or how many of them. I got the impression Stalin was just one of these guys. He figured he had an unending supply of people and he didn't really have to plan all that well about war. He just figured they'd be willing to die for the country or he'd probably kill them themselves if they didn't do what he said. But why somebody would let a conference be planned by the Russians, I thought it was a little bit funny, some of the stuff they had to deal with when they met. And I realize, I'm coming at this however many years later and stuff, 77 years later. But the place must have really been something to have all these people kind of shoehorned into this place. And they were trying, they're trying to plan after the war and stuff. And, all the beginnings before the Cold War began. But I thought the author did an excellent job for her first book, getting a lot of the details and sorting through it and stuff, because I got a little tired, during some of the, the interpersonal stuff. But that's kind of what made it interesting, too. But I'm always amazed in these kind of books how the egos and I'm wondering if anybody has ever been born with any self-esteem. These people that get in there and get their panties in a wad because they're not getting what they consider their due and stuff. I'm just always amazed at how many of these people that seem to lead the world have issues with self-esteem and know how to lead people. But, that's enough from me gassing on, but, I thought it was a good book, and like Mary Ellen said, we missed a lot of this time period. It seemed like I guess because it was it wasn't far enough back in history. So whenever we took American history, we were always done by the time we got to this time period. So it's good to get this kind of stuff and get a good presentation of what happened during this conference. It was obviously a big event. But anyway, thanks for recommending and thanks for leading us tonight.
You're welcome. Thanks for that. And let me, before I call on somebody else, who is 1619?
Jenny. That's Jenny in San Diego.
Jenny.
Yes, that's okay. Me. I can go if you like.
Okay. Yeah, go. We'll have you go.
I came to this book kind of late and I kind of skimmed it. It was, to me, I did have a relative, my dad actually, who was in World War II, And this book covered a period that I wasn't familiar with, and I think I'll come back to and try to figure out more about since I just skimmed the book. The thing, I agree with everything Alan said. I don't want to echo it. I think the thing that was touched on was the fragility of some of these leaders that we saw kind of in, you know, black and white, like Franklin Roosevelt. You know, Roosevelt, of course, had his, we knew he had, you know, polio and some problems, but I didn't realize he had some of the other problems and how, you know, they worked with them. And then Stalin. Actually, I have to confess, I should, when I get my computer back, I'll go on Google. I don't really know that much about Joseph Stalin. I know they played a pivotal part in the war. And so it was interesting to see him. We were seeing him and his daughter, you know, his daughter, and then they were relaying little bits about Stalin and Russia and things that were kind of shocking and, you know, nefarious. And then Avril Harriman, I remember hearing about him in the 60s. And so this was filling in some gaps. It was an intriguing book. I thought it was very clear and easy to read. It wasn't just something that called out to me at this time, but I will return back to it. And that's about all I have to say. That's it.
Let's see. Where'd Kathy go?
I need to unmute. Sorry. Michelle, you want to go?
Sure. I really enjoyed this book. I really like to read books about women in history. So this was right up my alley. There were a lot of really interesting details in the book. Like in the beginning, they talked about how the Harrimans lived in a 100,000 square foot home. I was like trying to imagine what this place must have looked like. It's huge. And even how in the 1930s, they, you know, started recognizing coronary artery disease, heart disease. I never really thought about that before. You know, that was like, I guess that's when they started recognizing that as you know, cardiology as a specialty. I found the descriptions of what it was like to be at Yalta with the lines for the restroom and the way they had to sleep. And it was just sounded crazy to me compared to, you think now when they have conferences, you know, for heads of state, they're all in like 5-star hotels and whatever. They were really roughing it in Yalta. I did have to look up where Yalta was because I really didn't know exactly where it was. For me, I think that the thing that I liked the best in the book was the letter from Lucy Snow to Anna after FDR died. I really found that very moving. I mean, regardless of what you think about the ethics or the morals of FDR having an affair, I thought it was nice that she gave Anna sort of the closure that I guess her mother really couldn't give her. It seemed like, you know, Kathy Harriman, she spoke Russian and, you know, she had sort of a role there. And then there was Sarah Churchill, who was in the military, the women's military. So she had her place there. But you sort of wondered about Anna Roosevelt. And, you know, it seemed like they had a little bit more difficult relationship. So I really did like that letter very much. I thought the book was really very, very interesting. And I like the idea of looking at history from the point of view of daughters, which is, you know, not the typical way that you really look at history. So I thought it was a good choice. So thanks.
Thank you. Let's see. I'm kind of going down this list I wrote myself. Lynn, let's see. All right. Lynn, you want to
okay,
go?
Okay, now I finally found the unmute button so I can unmute myself.
Okay, your turn.
I wasn't really anywhere familiar at all with the conference. I had heard about it in just in mentioning, and I knew there were several conferences. And as for where it was in history, I had no clue whatsoever. I had no clue at all. I never heard of Harriman before, or never heard in my readings, never came across his name before. And I just thought it was so unique that they would bring their daughters as sort of an aide-de-camp to help them in pretty much whatever needed to be done. And I guess the part about in the book that kind of got a little bit tedious to me was the arrangements that the daughters had to make, where who's sleeping who, who's using what bathroom, what bed they're going to sleep in, this all stuff. It kind of went on and on and on and on and on, going like, let's get over it, you know, come on. I read this book early in the month, and then I put it aside. And as I put it aside and did my other readings and stuff, I kept going back and thinking about parts of it. And, you know, that's just so typical to me of having the women, well, go get the coffee, you know, go fluff the pillows. But on the other hand, they also played an important role in helping their fathers get through this particular, what was it, 6 or 7 days. And I just thought, well, you know, that's, and for them to actually get to be there and witness this is something to be said about that. I enjoyed the book. I didn't think much of it. I was excited about reading it because I hadn't known anything about Yalta at all. One of the things that while I was reading the book and talking about how destructive apparently the Germans had gotten there, and then the Russians had to push them back out earlier in the war, and what a disaster the whole place was. And I couldn't help but think of the people now over in the Ukraine and in that peninsula that they're on. I liked the book when they break off and kind of go into a sort of a mini biographies of each character. And I really enjoyed that. I also kind of enjoyed sort of, it was just at the end when they went through each daughter and their families and the troubles that they had after the, you know, later on in the 50s and the 60s and stuff. That was like, that was, well, fascinating to me, but it was also like, oh gosh, I mean, like, I guess I was looking for a happy, you know, happy ever after story or something like that. And some of the stories that they had just wasn't working out with marriages. And I think there was one person that spent all the money, got married, and then she spent all the money that Harriman had accumulated all of his life. He remarried, and if I got that right. And I enjoy the book. I'll give it five thumbs up. Only got two thumbs up.
Well, thank you. And that was Pamela Churchill Harriman. And she was Churchill's daughter-in-law, but she divorced whatever son Churchill. And then she was sort of a gold digger, and she came over here. She was English. There's a biography about her and her marriage to Harriman. And so when she was married to Harriman here in the United States, she became a big Democratic fundraiser. And yeah, she spent all the money. So all the money that they had, she ended up spending it all. And I guess that the daughter, Kathleen, didn't get much at the end, if anything. So I'm glad you brought that up.
What wasn't she Randolph Churchill's first wife?
Yes, yeah. And that was Churchill's son, right?
Right, right. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Who is pretty bum, pretty much of a bum anyway.
Yes. And I guess she'd been, I guess she'd been.
She never took the name off, though. She was always Pamela Digby Churchill Hayward Harriman. She knew how to manipulate. If the book you're talking about is Reflected Glory by Sally Bedell Smith, she goes into how ruthless this woman was.
Yes. Well, and you could kind of, I mean, wasn't it in this book about, because Brad was talking about this to me, about the Harrimans and Pamela Churchill being in the same like hotel. And so instead of spending the night in her room, she'd go to Harriman's room, which was supposedly safer from the bombs. So I had kind of forgotten that, but Brad reminded me of that.
Yeah, she did.
She took advantage of, you know.
Yeah.
That was her.
She knew everybody and how to get everything. They said she was so well connected in British society. If you wanted Coca-Cola, which was just as rare as champagne in World War II London, she knew where to get it. She knew where to get everything, who was doing what and how to connect. She was the ultimate social connector, I heard, and she carried that through when she got here. Clinton appointed her ambassador to Paris, where she died. I think she was swimming in the Ritz swimming pool in 1997. She had plastic surgery, not that long before. So she was one of those well-kept kind of women. And she was considered by Sally Bedell Smith to be the last of the great courtesans in history.
Yes, yes. So do you want to go next?
I may as well, I guess. Yeah. Everybody has raised interesting points. I wanted to comment when Alan mentioned Russian casualties at 20 million. I have also heard that. In the book that I will be suggesting for August, there's an author's note, and in that author's note, the author says World War II was won by a combination of British intelligence, American steel, and Russian blood. And that's an interesting summation. If there ever was one, it may not be entirely accurate, but I think it's certainly worth considering. I had no idea Yalta was ravaged so badly by the Nazis. It sounded like a bomb site. They had to be careful where they went. The idea that there were bed bugs and things in this palace that had once been owned by the czars was shocking. The brutality on both sides, the Russians to the Germans and vice versa, and even Stalin to his own people was shocking. He even, one of his, I think his, was it his son who was a prisoner of war? I think he didn't care. He said, if you were a prisoner of war, you were basically considered a traitor. Yeah. That was just shocking to me, utterly shocking. I found the interplay between Kathleen Harriman, and of course that was going to be funny when Pamela would become her stepmother. They're about the same age. But anyway, that hadn't happened yet. Between Kathleen Harriman, between Anna Roosevelt and Sarah Churchill, to be very interesting. I didn't realize Anna was so controlling of who would have access to her father. I didn't realize he was quite as fragile as he was. It seemed like he was barely hanging on. It's a wonder he lasted into April.
Yeah.
He barely started his fourth term. You know, Truman had no wonder after Truman's second term, he didn't, you know, he didn't think he should run again. He was right because he basically had two terms. I think Churchill had Stalin's number. I think Roosevelt was scared to annoy Stalin because he had no, he wasn't sure how the nuclear bombs would affect Japan, and he wanted Russia to go after Japan, you know, if the atomic stuff wasn't working well, which is a shame. He couldn't have, you know, they couldn't have had foresight there because they could have kept Russia out of that part of the world if they had known that Japan would soon surrender after the bombs were dropped. And let me see if there was anything else I wanted to. I guess the only other thing I would mention is the daughters of privilege certainly live very different lives from everyone else. I mean, they get a window seat on history. They have connections, and they fly here and go there and do this and do that at a time when most people wouldn't have even been able to dream of such a thing. Fly across the Atlantic here, go there, vacation here, go there. So it definitely was. I like the book because by viewing this event through the lens of the relationship of the three women, it to me it brought it, it made it less dry and boring. you know, it showed you what the people were thinking, because a lot of history is so dry. You don't know what the people were really like. Like, is somebody nitpicky? Is somebody fussy? Is somebody easygoing? Is somebody haughty? You don't get that in a lot of history. Yeah. And that I've always thought was interesting, to see who was laid back and who was a bit neurotic.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you know who was neurotic and really awful was the ambassador to England from the United States, because he sent Roosevelt that telegram, and he started out, since you and Jimmy Burns didn't invite me to this thing. You know, I mean,
there was an ego there.
Yeah.
Well, they were all.
He killed himself. I think he was from New Hampshire. Wasn't that the one from New Hampshire? I think he may have killed himself. There were several suicides in this book.
Yeah, there were.
I believe he was. He was the ambassador after Joseph Kennedy.
Yeah, but what really gets me is, did anybody pick up on the fact that throughout history, Russia keeps picking these paranoid leaders? They don't learn.
No, they don't. They would seem to not to, except when they had Gorbachev, who seemed to be okay. Too bad we don't have another one like that now.
I think it probably has a lot to do with the way Russians are. You know,
their winter's too long. It's six months.
I'm not sure they're just mistakenly picking people like that. I have a feeling that's how they're grown.
Well, it also has a lot to do with the fact that who knows if they really picked them or if the person just took charge.
All right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think the people pick them. And Stalin was a ruthless murderer. So he got away with all that stuff because I've heard he's murdered millions and millions.
Yep.
And a lot of his own people just.
Well, I mean, it's kind of telling when the folks that were captured by the Germans didn't want to go back to the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. They wanted to stay with Germany and stuff.
Yeah, they knew what was going to happen to them.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. So.
Well, Sherry, you want to go next?
Sure. I'm going to be the exception, I guess, because I had a lot of trouble with this book. There was so much good information, but I don't know if it's her writing style. Since everybody else liked it, it was obviously me. I had trouble focusing on it. I found my mind wandering a lot, and I didn't enjoy it as much as everybody else. I thought it was interesting that these guys would take their daughters, but like Lynn said, they needed some women there to fluff the pillows and do the work that no one else wanted to do. And Eleanor was smart enough not to go because she didn't want to do it. And I thought it was incredible that Harriman would have his daughter break up his affair with Pamela, which clearly the breakup didn't last, but ask your daughter to do something like that. That's just shockingly inappropriate. That shows his character. I also thought it was interesting that, and I might have missed this, why was Yalta chosen? You would think Stalin would have wanted to show off the best of Russia, and maybe this was it at the time, but it certainly seemed like a pretty poor place to have such a conference with the bathroom issues and everything else. And lastly, I wanted to mention that there is a book on Bard about Stalin's daughter. She did come to live in the United States.
We covered it.
Okay.
We covered it. We did it.
Yeah, I couldn't remember, but it was
about 5 years.
Yeah, it was mine. We did it in December of 2018, maybe. Okay. It was Red, Red Daughter.
Something like that. Yeah. That was good.
Did y'all like it?
Lana Aleyeva.
Yeah, it was interesting. Yeah. Okay. She turned out better than you would predict with a father like that.
Yeah,
she did.
So that's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you. Those were good points. And I personally think Stalin picked Yalta to make the other allies jump through hoops and to kind of then they were all separated. So he was trying to work one against the other, and he was very good at that. And I just think by keeping them in so many different housing I guess, you know, I don't know. I guess those were big houses that they were in.
Mansions, right?
And they weren't really close or anything. You know, close, I mean, like, it was, they, like, Churchill and Roosevelt couldn't just go knock on each other's bedroom door and have a little talk in the evening when it was, you know, ended for the day. They were miles away from each other. So I just think...
The book also mentioned that Stalin did not want to leave the Soviet Union, which made me wonder, you know, if he left the Soviet Union, he may not be able to get back in.
I thought of that too, yeah.
But I was, you know, it was just kicking around the idea about, you know, what other place would there be besides Yalta? And, you know, the Europe was total wreck from the war that was still going on. So, you know, and nobody, and then I don't know where else in the Soviet Union, you know, how hard would it be, for everybody to go to Moscow, you know, so I'm not sure what other place there could be.
Right. And England was being bombed and I guess people didn't want to go to the U.S. So, yeah. Right.
And they had done the Middle East already. So
yeah, Tehran.
Yeah, they went to Tehran. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, they wouldn't have gotten Joseph Stalin to the United States, that's for sure. Yeah. So.
Yeah, he was probably afraid to come over here.
Who's next?
Okay, let's see. Well, Donald. Okay, he's. Well, let me see. LaDon.
Yes, that's me.
Okay, go ahead. Your turn.
Okay. I enjoyed the book quite a lot. I thought Kathy had the hardest part, especially in the beginning when she had to go there and make up all the places where people would sleep and what rooms they would have. She had to decide where people would sit and what position they would sit at the tables and everything. And so I thought that she had awfully big part in setting it up. I thought it was interesting. I thought that the water wasn't hardly fit to drink, so they drink in bottled water. But in the bottled water was a laxative. So with all the shortages of bathrooms and everything, they drink in laxatives. I thought that was kind of interesting. And I thought Stalin got the best of the negotiations. Maybe he held most of the cards right there, I think. And then, of course, he didn't live up to the negotiating terms anyway. But then I also enjoyed the story about the women after Yalta. Oh, by the way, I've seen pictures of the three of them at the Yalta conference. And Roosevelt did look awful. And if you've ever seen the pictures, famous pictures of a man sitting on a bench somewhere. Anyway, I thought that afterwards, Sarah, she felt that everyone that she loved, she brought bad luck to. She had one friend that she was in love with, but refused to marry when he wanted to marry her. And then a little later, he committed suicide. She had a husband, and he committed suicide. Her father lost an election that they were almost certain that they were going to win. She just felt like she brought everybody bad luck. And then at one point, she drank a lot, and one time she was arrested for public drunkenness. Can you imagine that? The president's son being arrested for public drunkenness. And so that was bad. So I felt bad for her. Kathy, also her husband, tried to kill himself with a shotgun, you know. And so everything wasn't like, if you were writing this book, as a fiction, you might end it with a happy living happy ever after. I didn't think they were all that happy. Anna I think did the turned out the best. She was able to give money and to run help people run for office in the Democratic Party and everything. So that was about as much. I thought the part after Yalta about the women and how their lives turn out, and you know what, there's a term now. It used to be called shell shock back in those days, when a person go. We have another term for that now.
PTSD.
Yeah. There was a lot of that, and I think that, you know, some of those people shooting themselves and killing themselves and having all that must have been because they were in the war up close and personal, as it goes, you know. So a lot of things going on. And the part after the book of how their lives turned out was as interesting to me as was their part in, they were, I would think, fluffing the pillow, and that's a little much to, you know, to belittling the women for the things that they actually did and helping their husband, being someone said aide-de-camp. Yeah, that's what it was. It wasn't fluffing pillows. It was really being taken part. And Churchill, he reflected bounced ideas off his daughter and everything and relied on her quite a lot. And he was in a pretty, you know, depressed mood with the way he couldn't get anything done with Poland. You know, England went to war because Germany invaded Poland in 39. And now here's the end of the war practically, and you can't get any agreements on that. You couldn't even bring it up and talk about it. So he was very depressed, and his daughter helped him get through that too. So I think that saying the women were pillow fluffers is a little flippant. So anyway.
I take that back a little bit. I didn't quite. They did a huge amount more than that. But I think one of the reasons they were taken along was
to provide that domestic stuff.
Right, to provide that extra domestic stuff that they wouldn't get a regular male aide-de-camp to do.
Yeah, but they could have taken sons. They could have taken other people, but they took their daughters.
Think the sons would have made dining arrangements.
No, but then you think Kathleen, she had such a big job because she knew Russian. Mm-hmm. And how I thought it was pretty thing how she learned Russian. You know, she learned it. Yeah, she would quickly. say, go down the walk down the street, saying words to herself and phrases and everything. She must have been an awful intelligent person. Far
but
above
can you
anything
imagine how scared? How scared Russians must have been. They couldn't talk to her. Only certain people connected with the Russian diplomatic service could talk to her, and there was. So much, you had to be so careful what you said there, or the NKVD or whatever it was would get you.
Yeah, standing right behind. Go ahead.
Fast forward 5 months, and you have Potsdam, which is the final agreement, which I wish we could find a book on it, because I can't exactly remember what the reason for that was, but Truman is president, and he had figured out what Stalin had been playing at. And he got in that conference and really told Stalin off used Harry Truman-esque language to the guy.
I think
Roosevelt.
Yeah, Roosevelt.
Potsdam is very interesting.
Roosevelt was relying too much on, I've made this guy my good buddy. Mm-hmm. You know, they understood one another. He's gonna come around because he likes me. I think Roosevelt was, I got less respect for Roosevelt through this book than I've had out throughout a lifetime of
understanding this. He wasn't at his best.
No,
well, I think he was just so sick. He was worn out.
If you've ever seen that picture, you can tell he was worn out.
He really should have taken Truman along with him.
Well, he didn't let Truman do anything.
I know. Right. Yeah. That's real.
So, okay, you know, that's my comments. And so if there's another person that needs to speak.
We'll go on. We'll go on just a second. And I'll just say this, that I had the book and it had the pictures in it. There were a lot of pictures and it was very interesting. Because Roosevelt looked terrible, even in the black and white photos, he looked gray. And I mean, Stalin knew, had to have known he was dying. And the other thing is the women, the daughters were always in dresses. And I just was, and it was cold there. So they were in, winter coats and dresses. And in one picture, maybe Kathleen Harriman had on boots, but I just thought, how can they stand it? It's cold there. And they got, bare legs. I'm sure they had some kind of hose on, but anyway, but the photos make it's just very clear that Roosevelt was very, very sick in those photos. So,
Where Don was saying.
We got two people that haven't been called on.
Joni, are you here? Well, Liz?
Yes.
Joni's here.
Okay.
Well, I have to agree with Sherry. I really tried to read this book, but it seems like I was interested in it, but it seemed like it just would. It seems like reading, I was trying to read a couple hours a day so that I would get it read. And it seemed like it took 5 hours to read 1 hour's worth of stuff. There was so much in it. But it was interesting because I was about 5 years old when Yalta was going on. I didn't understand it. I heard the word Yalta. But I found out in the 50s how horrible Stalin was and how scary. I mean, he didn't like somebody. He would just have them shot. And people close to him in his administration, the head of the secret police, shot. And all his closest people that he had working for and with him shot if they said a word that he didn't approve of. I found the book. I wasn't thrilled with the reader, and yet I might go back to it because although it was a little bit confusing to me, trying to follow each of the daughters and it would hold my interest for a little while, then it would get too long and boring for me. I think for me it could have been condensed. But I did read the book that Svetlana wrote, how she was married to Frank Lloyd Wright. And all the difficulties. And then when she had the choice of, she could either stay in the U.S. or go back to Russia and be near her children's graves. I was not surprised, but I was surprised that she would choose that path. Anyway, it was, I liked parts of it. I remember when Harriman was governor, I remember all this stuff. And so it was, and Roosevelt had at least two affairs. And he and Eleanor were just she was such a goer and doer and trying to help people so much. And it was just, I mean, I had read a lot of books about Franklin. And so anyway, that's my take on it. I really tried to read it. I got about 5.5 hours read. And I may go back to it. I don't know. But thanks for listening to me.
Thank you, Joni. Well, Liz, you're up.
Okay.
Alan says.
Yeah. Okay. I don't have anything profound to say beyond what has already been said. I only got about 5.5 hours through the book. But listening to what happens at the end of the book, I definitely want to go back and read more. It was interesting. It did get a little bit cumbersome with facts and details and such. But one of the things that while I was reading the book, I kept thinking about Andrew Johnson's daughter and the important roles that she played and how much she traveled with him. And I think that that is probably a little bit more common than, you know, than, I mean, it's just nice to talk about the importance of the family members of these big leaders that all we learn about. I mean, that's all we learn about in school are the leaders. We don't hear about all the work that their families do. And I mean, it really is when you're running for public office like that, it is a family affair. And, you know, it's very unusual that at least one or two of the other family members are not, you know, vital to the success of that leader. And we just don't hear enough about that. So I'm glad that they took the time to talk about the importance of these daughters and how they helped to really bring Yalta about and make it a success. So thanks for choosing the book.
Okay.
I wanted to add one last thing. I didn't know that the Katyn massacre, which I had always thought was something the Nazis had done to the Polish officer corps, was a sneaky Russian thing that would frame Germany. That was ghastly.
Yeah, it was ghastly. Yeah.
Well,
not surprising, but ghastly.
The siege of Warsaw was ghastly. That's what I was going to bring up.
Yeah, they wouldn't help them. They wanted the city destroyed, so they let the Nazis blow them up.
And so
that was ghastly too.
I was reading this book sometime in March, I guess. And so I was just thinking this whole time, I was like, well, no wonder Poland is so eager to help Ukraine at this point. And I felt like so much of this story involves some of the countries, well, they weren't countries then, but, you know, that some of the conflicts that we have now over there in Ukraine with Russia. I just reading this book, it just stunned me, kind of like it feels like it's almost round two in some of it. And then last thing I'll bring up is that, did you guys find it interesting how Stalin had everything bugged? And I mean, I don't know if Churchill knew, but Roosevelt didn't seem very aware, you know, that everything, you know, was bugged, and they'd be speaking about something like wanting lemons, and then there were lemon trees. So
I was surprised. Roosevelt just seemed clueless. I mean, I know he was sick and stuff, but man, to be someone that had been leading our country for going into four terms and stuff, he just didn't have a clue about Russia, didn't seem like. And I just found that amazing. I've got one question. There was one section where I believe it was about Anna, and I think Anna was talking to her husband John, and they kept referring to Roosevelt as OM. What did that stand for?
Old man.
Okay, I thought maybe it was Our Majesty, but I couldn't say that.
Okay.
Well, I think Roosevelt probably, with the heart condition he had, he probably wasn't getting as much oxygen to his brain and was just failing. So some of his poor decision-making probably stemmed a lot from that, because my dad died from congestive heart failure. And at the end, I mean, his brain, he didn't have dementia, but his brain he didn't make, there was no wisdom left. He, you know, so anyway,
Oh, anybody that went to Yalta thinking they were going to be good buddies with Stalin obviously wasn't getting oxygen to their brains. Yeah,
he thought he thought he could trust Stalin. He really thought he could trust him. Uncle Joe. Uncle Joe.
Yeah.
You know, the original way. Uncle Joe.
Yeah. Petticoat Junction.
Lynn was going to say something a while ago and didn't get in. Lynn, did you have something? Well, maybe I misheard.
I think he did.
Lynn?
Yeah, this is Lynn. Yeah. Can y'all hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was just was thinking about, what Don had said about maybe there's some kind of a relationship between Roosevelt and Stalin, and maybe they could work things out between each other and be buddies. And it just reminded me that of a quote from George Walker Bush when Putin was invited to the ranch, his ranch out in Texas. And the quote goes something like this: I've looked into the man's soul and he seems to be okay.
Yeah, right.
And then again, right. You know, we jump ahead.
I bet he's had second thoughts.
Then we jump ahead. And now we got Trump and we got Putin again. And with that little thing in the summit that they had, and they go off together alone, just with the interpreters, and who knows what was said there, but they seem to be, I don't know what Putin felt about Trump, but to me, Trump was like, we're best buddies,
But you know what? These presidents, they cannot come out and just say something shitty about Putin. They have to be careful in their words, what they privately think. And there were, I don't know. And everybody says that about Trump. But, I've heard him many times also say Putin's like evil and a bad guy and this and that and the other. So I don't know. I think these presidents are just faking it, making nice. He looked into his soul, but whatever.
Yeah. Well, I think we can agree that Putin sure seems to be the reincarnation of Stalin.
Yeah. Yes.
When Yeltsin picked Putin, he thought that he was going to continue perestroika. What was that? What it was called?
Perestroika.
Yeah. And he thought he would do it. But, the man that when you get a little bit of power, Hitler, when he came to power in Germany, he was only supported by 40% of the German people. Mm-hmm. But when you get up there and you start putting the power together, and that's what Putin has done, I was really, really thinking that we were going to be able to get along with Russia back then. And I was really proud of our relationship with him. But then when Yeltsin was kind of a drunk, and he couldn't handle the office, so he picked up Putin.
Yeltsin was a drunk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They all are.
Yeah, well, he was.
And, Putin hangs on to his power by being more powerful.
Yeah.
And he can't step down and he can't stop in Ukraine, because then he won't wake up tomorrow. So it's just a dog-eat-dog government over there. They just are jockeying, same as kind of in all these communist governments. It isn't you don't do your time and move along to being billionaires like over here. So he's not going to give up in Ukraine. That's what I saw reading this book, right about the time he invaded.
Putin is one of the world's wealthiest men,
If we don't
know how he made his money, go ahead.
If we don't be careful and safeguard our politics, we can slip into that too. Mm-hmm. Other democracies have slipped into a strongman rule, one strongman rule. So we have to be very careful. Just because we were given democracy of when we were born. We don't, we're not necessarily going to keep it if we don't pay attention.
For sure.
And do
something. It's almost choice for the Tuesday, August 2nd, 2022 Journey Through History discussion is The Diamond Eye by Kate Quinn. The DV number is DB107522. The book is set during World War II, as was Quinn's most recent novel, The Rose Code. I chose this book for its Russian and Ukrainian settings. Be warned, there is violence. Join me Tuesday, August 2nd, 2022, for The Diamond Eye by Kate Quinn, DB107522.
Okay, that's it. You can unmute yourselves.
Good discussion, Kathy.
Well, thank you. I did it. Yeah. We did it. We did it. Y'all did it. So,
yeah. Listen, I do realize we're at the end of our time, but Don did manage to get the recording to me. If anybody wants to stick around, I've got time to play it if you're interested. I know, like I said, we're at the end of our hour, but if anyone's interested in hearing it, it's 30 minutes. And
I definitely want to hear it. I was going to ask if you could send it to us,
yeah,
but yeah,
I finally
we can play
got it
now.
It was Don. There was a little technical snafu, but he got me the correct file. And if you guys are interested, we can go ahead and play
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I
and
definitely
leave the
vote
recording
for now.
Going as well. And
sure.
It'll be on there. And then the powers that be can decide if they want to include the whole thing or not. So if you guys are ready, I'll go ahead and do it.
Okay.
Go for it.
Thank you, Brad.
Here we go. Hold it. I got to cue it up. I didn't get it cued. Just 1 second. Okay, here we go.
You have started computer audio share. QuickTime Player. QuickTime Player. Journey 5, voiceover off.
Catherine Grace Katz is a writer and historian from Chicago. She graduated from Harvard in 2013 with a BA in history and received her Master in Philosophy in Modern European History from Christ's College, Cambridge in 2014, where she wrote her dissertation on the origins of modern counterintelligence practices. After graduating, Catherine worked in finance in New York City before returning to history and writing. She is currently pursuing her JD at Harvard Law School.
And it was really synchronicity that this all kind of came, this story came into your lap. Well, it's preparation meets providence.
Exactly.
Because in your office building, there was a bookstore devoted to Winston Churchill. And since you were already interested in Churchill from your earlier studies, you were frequenting it and then got to know the society that studies Churchill and then the family, and then these papers were opened up to you of Sarah Churchill. That's amazing, really. That has changed your life, really.
Absolutely. I will never forget, after going to this bookstore many times, the owner of the bookstore realizing the depth of my interest in history, and Churchill had been a part of my undergrad thesis at Harvard and then graduate dissertation at Cambridge, and he'd connected me with the Churchill Society and then ultimately the Churchill family. And I remember after meeting them for the first time, walking home from the office late one night and talking to my mom as I went, and she said, oh, you never know when these kinds of occurrences can really change the direction of your life. And sure enough, they did. And you know, I think that just goes to show moms always know best, so always listen to your mom.
And so, and in these papers that were opened up to you, in the Sarah Churchill's papers, how did you get from exploring those letters of Sarah to this broader story about the daughters at Yalta?
Yeah, so when I went to look at Sarah's papers initially, which was the basis of this article that I was writing about the opening of her archive, I became fascinated with her wartime experience. And despite having studied the Tehran and Yalta conferences many times in school, I'd never realized that she had been her father's aide, and then her role as a daughter diplomat at Tehran had inspired the other two fathers to bring their daughters to Yalta. And thanks to the Churchill family, they made an introduction to Kathleen Harriman's family. Sarah Churchill had been writing to her mother consistently throughout Yalta, and I found all of those letters in her archives. And Kathleen was writing to several people, her sister, her former governess, Pamela Churchill, who was Winston Churchill's daughter-in-law and also was having an affair with Averill Harriman. So a lot of great sources there. And through Kathleen Harriman's family, I also connected with Anna Roosevelt's family. Her papers are at the FDR library, but her daughter, Ellie, is still alive, and she was 18 at the time of Yalta and has wonderful memories at that time, and Anna's son as well. So this perfect chance to have access to brand new documents that nobody had seen before, and also interview people who knew and loved these individuals more than anyone else in the world, and that was a really exceptional opportunity.
So you mentioned that the other two men brought their daughters because they knew that Winston was bringing Sarah. So they were convinced by that to bring their own? Is that how that happened?
Yes. So FDR actually writes explicitly to Churchill in January 1945 and says, if you're thinking of bringing Sarah again to this conference, I'm thinking of bringing my daughter Anna. And if Anna Roosevelt was coming, then based on protocol, it would be appropriate for Kathleen Harriman to also come. And so she had her opportunity to come and extend her work with her father. And the three of them had a chance unlike any other three women and young women in history.
Set the scene of February 1945. What's going on in the world as they prepare for this Yalta conference?
February 1945, it looks like the war in Europe is finally coming to a close sometime in the late spring or early summer. The Battle of the Bulge has just ended by the time they all gather at Yalta. So the time has come for the big three to discuss some important issues that will affect Europe as they transition to the post-war period, especially what to do about Germany. Should Germany be allowed to remain one country, or should it be broken up into a group of smaller states in hopes that they don't rise up as a belligerent for a third time in half a century? Also extremely important, especially to Winston Churchill, is the future of Poland and Polish sovereignty. Britain went to war in defense of Polish sovereignty at the very beginning, and he wants to make sure that when he returns to London when the conference is over, that he doesn't look the Polish government in exile in the eye and tell them that they weren't able to secure the very thing they went to defend in the first place. Stalin, of course, has some other ideas when it comes to Poland. He wants to make sure that he has friendly neighbors, as he calls it, on his borders, recognizing that the flatlands of Poland has been a weakness for Russia and the Soviet Union dating all the way back to the Napoleonic era. And in exchange for everything that the Soviet Union has sacrificed, he wants to make sure that he's able to secure that in the end. Meanwhile, in the Pacific, the war is not quite as advanced. They don't yet know if the atomic bomb and Manhattan Project will be a success. So Roosevelt's looking at the potential for a ground invasion of the Japanese home islands, which could lead to the deaths of 200,000 American soldiers and potentially take another 18 months. So he wants to save as many American lives as possible. And to do that, he wants to bring the Soviet Union into the war there, have them break their pact of neutrality with Japan in exchange for some territorial concessions. And also extremely important to FDR is something that he really considers part of his personal legacy. He wants to succeed where Woodrow Wilson failed at the end of World War I with the League of Nations by creating a new international peace organization called the United Nations, not only as a way to secure peace, if not forever, certainly peace in Europe for at least 50 years. And he also sees this as a way to bring the Soviet Union into the international community after the war is over and the common enemy has been defeated. So that is what they've come to Yalta to discuss, among a number of other things. But those are kind of the core issues on the docket for the conference.
So you've got these historic giants, on the world stage: Churchill, Stalin, Roosevelt, Averill Harriman. But your book focuses on the three daughters, and it's really very interesting the different perspectives they bring to this moment. Why don't you give us a quick bio of the three women, and then we'll talk about the complex interrelationship between the three of them.
Sure. Sarah Churchill was the first of the daughters to be able to attend one of these international conferences with her father, which she did for the first time in 1943 at the Tehran Conference. And Sarah, if people know her today, it's usually in the context of her having been an actress and a dancer. She even starred in a movie with Fred Astaire in 1951 called Royal Wedding. But before that, she had had a very close relationship with her father from the time she was a little girl. She felt that she could understand his mind, even if he wasn't speaking, that she could follow, as she said, in silent step with him. And so they had this really close bond since she was a little girl. She wanted to carve out a name for herself. And in a time when there are few careers open to a woman of her class and her era, she decided to become an actress, something that her father was actually surprisingly supportive of. And she had a lot of his same spirit in wanting to make her mark on the world. But when the war broke out, she decided to do her bit for the country and join the women's branch of the Royal Air Force, where she served as an intelligence analyst for the photographic interpretation unit, looking at aerial photos to make intelligence assessments in support of Allied operations, especially in the Mediterranean. And early in the war, Winston and Clementine Churchill had decided that when he traveled abroad, someone from the family should go with him as a confidant and protector, but also as an unofficial family historian, knowing that he would want to write his wartime memoirs when it was all over. So for a variety of reasons, Sarah having this really close understanding of her father and the way that he thought about the world and problems, her acting ability, which actually fit really well with the skills that you need to be a diplomat. You know, so much of it is kind of almost like acting, you know, on the world stage. Her understanding of military operations, and she also had a real grasp of domestic and foreign policy. And she shared with her father his incredible command of language. She was a beautiful writer, and she was really the person to capture all of those details taking place outside of the official conference negotiations. So for that kind of four-pronged reason, she was the perfect one to join him, first at Tehran, and then he brought her again to Yalta in 1945. And it was because of what a valuable role she played for her father, as I like to think of it as a daughter diplomat at Tehran. Both FDR and Avril Harriman then realized that their daughters could serve a similar role for them at Yalta. Avril Harriman and his daughter Kathleen had not been especially close when she was a little girl. He was always away chasing business deals. He had been the chairman of Union Pacific Railroad, the founder of Brown Brothers Harriman, Newsweek, Sun Valley. And it was only after his then ex-wife, Kathleen's mother, died when Kathy was a teenager that they began to build what was really more like a partnership between colleagues, almost more so than father and daughter, that would see them through the next number of years. He was surprisingly ahead of his time in wanting to involve his daughters in his public life and his work as much as it interested them. And his daughter Kathleen shared his sense of adventure and jumped at the chance to join him first when he went to London as a Lend-Lease envoy in 1941 before the Americans entered the war. And Kathleen joined him there as a war reporter, where she and her father became very close friends with the Churchill family, Pamela Churchill in particular, which we might get to a little later. And then Kathleen extended her time with him in 1943 when he became the American ambassador to the Soviet Union. She learned to speak Russian and really became in many ways his assistant ambassador there, and had more access to and experience with Stalin and his inner circle than any other American woman in history, which I find fascinating, especially since so few people are familiar with her today. So with her language skills and experience working with the Americans and the Soviets in Moscow, she really could serve as a liaison between the American and Soviet advance teams, overseeing all the details, almost like we think of like a protocol officer at the State Department today, and also helping the American diplomats who are coming, who had never been to the Soviet Union before, with that cultural transition, briefing them, preparing materials to help them better understand their environment. And finally, Anna Roosevelt. So I should mention, Sarah Churchill was 30 at the time of Yalta. Kathleen was 27. And Anna was 38. And she was the only mother among them. She had three children. And despite the fact she was the oldest, she was actually the least experienced in the foreign policy realm compared to the other daughters. Not for lack of trying, but really because FDR had always held her at arm's length when she wanted to be involved in the way that he had involved her younger brothers throughout the war, often turning to them to serve as his aides in previous meetings with Churchill and Stalin, largely as physical supporters to help him stand and move. But by 1945, Anna had begun to occupy a really important place in the White House. She had been living in Seattle with her husband and children, and she and her husband were the editors of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer newspapers. But when her husband joined the army, Anna moved home and realized that FDR was not well. insisted that he have a comprehensive medical examination, which revealed he was dying of congestive heart failure. Anna and the doctor were sworn to secrecy. They were the only people who knew. And so she really became her father's gatekeeper, doing anything and everything she could to literally keep him alive to survive to the end of the war. And so when she finally has her chance to come with him to Yalta, it's because he knows that she is valiantly protecting him. You know, he doesn't know exactly what's wrong with him, really never asks about his health condition. But he knows that he needs Anna to get through these difficult weeks of the conference, where she is his gatekeeper throughout the duration of their time together, all the while harboring this, you know, the secret that her father is dying, unable to tell anyone in this incredibly charged environment.
You do a great job of drawing their personalities through the anecdotes you tell that are outside of Yalta. The whole idea that Kathy Harriman was a downhill ski racer and her father, Abel Harriman, created essentially America's first ski resort, and that she was this sort of incredible athlete who competed even sort of off the top of the cup against these Russian skiers, you know, with used and lent equipment, and she still came in third. And I love the story you had about Sarah, where Winston Churchill was talking about the invasion of North Africa, and he said something like, yeah, there are 500 British ships in the Mediterranean right now. And she corrected him and said, no, it's 282. And he couldn't understand how she knew that. But I think with Anna, you know, you spend a fair amount of time trying to explain her relationship with Eleanor, which obviously mm-hmm. is very complicated. Could you talk a little bit about what Anna had been doing sort of behind Eleanor's back to help her father in those later months of 1944, and how that impacted her relationship with the president?
Sure. Well, as you point out, each of these daughters, they have really distinct personalities and different factors that make them, you know, such a valuable partner for their fathers at this moment. But for Anna, she had always wanted to be someone of the utmost importance and value at her father's side. This is something that she'd been trying to recapture from the time she was a very little girl. She and he had had a close bond when she was little. They really had this shared love of the natural world and the environment, and would take long horseback rides throughout the throughout Hyde Park. And he would teach her about nature. And someday she dreamed that she would become almost like a co-custodian with him of their home and their land in the Hudson River Valley. And of course, his polio diagnosis changed all of this. And suddenly Anna found herself very much held at arm's length, on the outside looking in, sent away to school, expected to become a debutante. And so she's trying to recapture these fleeting childhood memories of its closeness with him. Throughout the war, both Anna and Eleanor had wanted to join him at one of his overseas conferences with Churchill and or Stalin. And he had kind of put them aside, you know, instead turning to the sons as his aides. And Anna and Eleanor had corresponded with each other with their shared frustration that FDR expected the women in his life to keep the home fires burning, which is kind of a surprising thing to see them talk about, because you think of FDR as being very progressive in many ways and being a real partner with Eleanor. But by the time the Yalta conference occurs, FDR is extremely ill. He is dying of congestive heart failure. He dies just 8 weeks after the Yalta conference ends. And he doesn't want to bring Eleanor with him to the conference, in part because this is a real concern that if you bring your wife to the conference, the Soviets will then feel the obligation to provide even grander trappings. And it takes away from the actual time that they have for meetings and negotiations. And FDR, even though he doesn't know quite what's wrong with him, realizes that he needs to prioritize, you know, the efficient working of the conference. So that's one reason that he's resistant to bringing Eleanor. And the other, you know, this is, you know, very unfortunate and quite sad, kind of given the partnership that they'd had for so many years, that he, well, Eleanor has so many positive contributions that she brought to his administration and a real energy and zeal for reform and for policy. I think he felt that that could, you know, take away from some of the energy that he had to focus on the issues at hand. And so while Eleanor would be trying, you know, very valiantly to pursue certain political agendas, he kind of needed to focus his attention on just what needed to be discussed at Yalta, and thought that by bringing Anna, that could be a way to just kind of have her be her a support and assistant without additional kind of work and advocacy going on outside of the main line of negotiation. And so Eleanor feels very betrayed that Anna has a chance to go with him for this conference. And Anna feels quite guilty about taking her mother's place in some ways. But she also knows this is probably her last chance to be her father's valued partner in an environment like this, and that he very well may die soon. And so she kind of rationalizes his reasoning about, you know, not wanting to impose all these extra burdens on the Soviets by bringing your wife, and kind of explains it away for herself in that moment of, you know, why Eleanor couldn't go and why she should go instead. But it is something that plagues her in the years that follow, and that she reflects back on, kind of taking her mother's place for this last opportunity to attend one of these important international summits. And she knows how much it's betrayed her mother, in addition to the fact that she's been keeping his continued association with Lucy Mercer a secret from Eleanor as well.
Now, the cover of the book shows the three women in front of the Tsar's palace in Yalta. It was a terrible situation. The Germans had destroyed most of this area. Everything was run down. Talk a little bit about the jobs that the three of the women had to do, basically in sort of managing their delegations.
It is the Tsar's summer palace, but it is falling apart. It is just an elegant facade masking what really, you know, lies within. It had been the Tsar's resort on the Black Sea, where he came with his family as a retreat kind of from the pressures of court life. But then in 1917, after the Russian Revolution, the palace was nationalized by the Soviets and turned into a rest home for Soviet workers. And then when the Nazis invade the Crimea, they use Livadia Palace as their headquarters. The Soviets push them out several months before the Yalta Conference takes place. And on their way, the Nazis strip the palace of everything that they could carry, you know, literally like all of the furniture, the art, the dishes, and the lamps, down to the doorknobs, which they could strip out and melt down as scrap metal. And so the Soviets have just 3 weeks from the time that they all agree this is where they're going to hold the conference to restock this villa with everything that they need. So they take the contents of glamorous hotels in Moscow, like the Hotel Metropole, and transport it by train 1,000 miles south, restock the villa, kind of throwing manpower at the situation as the Soviets do so well, and then just requisitioning everyday items out of local people's homes, like ashtrays and coat hangers, taking these items from people whose lives had been pretty summarily destroyed by the war. And then, you know, in addition to the Nazis, there have been some other invaders, namely bed bugs that are all throughout the palace. The American advance teams have to use DDT to try to douse the palace and exterminate the bugs. Of course, that method, we now know, probably wasn't the healthiest thing to do. It also doesn't get rid of the electronic bugs that the Soviets had planted throughout the compound. that's a different issue. And so Kathleen Harriman arrives there before the conference takes place with her father. He's supposed to be kind of overseeing the management and the preparation of Livadia Palace for Roosevelt. Roosevelt will be staying at Livadia Palace, and that's where all the conference meetings will be held. The three delegations agree that that will be easiest, since Roosevelt is paralyzed, so he doesn't have to travel to one of the other sites. But Kathleen Harriman is left at Yalta by her father, who goes off to Malta to rendezvous with FDR and Churchill. They're meeting there to then fly the last leg to Yalta, which is a very dangerous journey. Roosevelt traveling by ship in a destroyer convoy, but they're still sighting enemy U-boats. Churchill flying from London. One of his planes carrying Foreign Office experts actually tragically crashes off the coast of Italy, and several Foreign Office experts are killed. Then they have to fly in unpressurized planes over enemy-occupied islands with anti-aircraft units. So it really is an incredibly onerous and dangerous journey, and it's remarkable that they were willing to make it. But Stalin refused to meet anywhere outside of his own borders, because he was really paranoid about security. And so that's the reason that they come all the way to him, kind of recognizing that he holds more cards than they do at this point. They want him to, you know, join the war in the Pacific, to agree to free elections in Poland, and so that they're going to have to come to his turf. So Kathleen is left by her father to be the liaison, working with the Soviets and the American advance teams, making sure not only that everything is habitable, but also accessible for Roosevelt. And so she's there, you know, speaking Russian, speaking English, kind of as all the work is going on. But Kathleen, she's kind of just left here as a 27-year-old girl amidst some of the most fearsome people in the Soviet Union, you know, including the NKVD.
Particularly for Anna, because everyone wanted a piece of Roosevelt. And he was, as you said, quite ill at this point. So Anna is constantly trying to defend him. And there's all of these big egos who are offended if they don't get invited to a lunch or don't get invited to a dinner, or they don't like their bedroom, or they have to wait in line to use the bathroom. you talk about how Anna dealt with protecting her father while all these incredibly powerful men were trying to get at him.
Absolutely. One of the most important people trying to meet with him, of course, is Winston Churchill, who really wants to have a one-on-one meeting with FDR in advance of meeting Stalin. FDR doesn't want to do this because he's afraid this will make Stalin think that the two of them are ganging up on him. And he's very focused on building a bridge with Stalin as he recognizes the rising importance of the Soviet Union in the post-war world. And so, you know, there are all these people constantly trying to get in for a meeting with Roosevelt, you know, not just Churchill, but all of the Edward Stettinius, the American Secretary of State, Harry Hopkins, who's been somewhat sidelined by Roosevelt at this point. And Anna's kind of stepped in as gatekeeper where Harry Hopkins once was. And so this tension between Anna and Hopkins, it's not just about, you know, this person wants to meet him, you know, this person wants to meet him, but Hopkins kind of arguing Churchill and Roosevelt should have this meeting in advance. He should outline a united strategy with Churchill before he goes to meet with Stalin. Anna kind of adopting her father's, you know, Stalin will think that Churchill and Roosevelt are ganging up on him. And unfortunately, Anna, she doesn't have as much of the experience. I mean, she was a very capable person, but there is some element of just having the experience of a Harry Hopkins to be able to navigate that really difficult environment where people all want to meet with him. On top of which, she's carrying this horrible secret of the fact that he's dying. And so Harry Hopkins and Anna really butt heads throughout the conference. Hopkins arguing with her that, you know, Roosevelt has, you know, chosen this life. He's chosen to run for election and, you know, become elected once again. And so he has to accept the responsibilities that come with that. And Anna, you know, saying, no, I think you're wrong. I think you're just too pro-British. This is fine. And he, you know, should not meet with Churchill alone before he meets with Stalin. And so it is kind of this, you know, the rise and fall of, you know, Harry Hopkins, who's also incredibly sick, dying of stomach cancer. He's made this Herculean effort to get there. He feels like FDR should be making as much effort as, you know, Harry Hopkins is. And Anna kind of not having the full scope of seeing all the parties involved like Hopkins might be, but knowing the secret of her father's health, which Harry Hopkins doesn't know. And so it's kind of each of them have their own agenda as they're trying to carve out their place as the person who is FDR's right-hand man. And I can't imagine, you know, trying to balance all those personalities, everybody, you know, wanting to be in on the meeting, wanting a seat at the table at dinner, being offended if they haven't been invited to a simple lunch. And all the while, Anna's just literally trying to do anything she can to keep her father alive.
Aftermath of the conference is quite interesting. The journey home for Anna, they stop at the Great Bitter Lake, and FDR meets with Ibn Saud and Haile Selassie and King Farouk and, you know, one of FDR's closest associates, Pa Watson, dies on the ship back. Harry Hopkins is so sick, he has to be flown. I think he goes right to the Mayo Clinic or something. Initially, the summit is perceived as a great success. Then very quickly, people start attacking it and criticizing it. What about the aftermath and how it affected these three women as they sort of went back to their former lives, but they were forever changed?
Yes. For each of them, it really was kind of this last opportunity to use the skills and abilities that they had, like so many young women who had this window of opportunity during the war, to do what they knew that they could do, but yet they knew that once the war ended, which was something everyone was looking forward to, of course, but the world would change again and they'd be on the outside looking in. And that's the case as much for these daughters as it is for so many, you know, millions of other women around the world and their lives during the war, you know, during the war and then just shortly after. And I think for each of them, they all recognized this and they knew that they were living through a momentous occasion in history. And several of them write about it, explicitly addressing the fact that they know that they're living through and witnessing and participating in history. And so, you know, the immediate aftermath, it's kind of lauded as this great celebration of Allied unity and a victory. But it's clear to the participants that it's not quite as simple as it seems. Churchill comes back to London, is very, you know, much trying to sell the conference to Parliament. Meanwhile, privately, he's very concerned about the state of affairs with the Soviet Union. Roosevelt comes home, addresses Congress, and he addresses Congress sitting down for the first time in his life, which is a really striking visual to see. You know, he recognizes and outwardly acknowledges the fact that he's paralyzed for the first time in that environment, which is really fascinating. But for each of the daughters, I think Kathleen Harriman immediately after is kind of swept up in this
jubilation before realizing, you know, she knows better. She knows what it's like to be living amongst the Soviets, where, you know, what they say can just be reversed tomorrow on a whim. And so she is kind of, you know, it quickly comes to that realization as soon as she gets back home to Moscow. For Sarah Churchill, she returns to her work as a WAF. And then her father is caught up in the immediate aftermath of, you know, the 1945 general election. And she could see that while people don't necessarily, you know, dislike Churchill, they still love him and admire him for, you know, really winning the war for Britain. But people are exhausted. They're tired of rationing. They just need a change and a break and a recognition for the sacrifices they've made. So she's kind of warning her father in a letter that she writes to him about, you know, some of the concerns that she has about his campaign and the way he's looking at the future compared to the what she's hearing from the people that she works with at RAF Medmenham. And then for Anna, it kind of comes to light just how involved she's been in FDR's administration, not just at Yalta, but over the last year. When there's a big expose that's written about her and the fact that she attended the conference in Life magazine. And so it kind of puts her in, you know, front and center for the first time when she's really been behind the scenes the whole time. And the writer of the article kind of asks, you know, just how involved is Anna and what kind of influence is she having over the president? Suddenly, the reality she's known for her entire adult life of being the daughter of the president is gone. Her home is gone, not just, you know, the White House, but also Springwood and Hyde Park, which FDR has decided should go to the American government to be the FDR Presidential Library and Museum, which is a wonderful resource. But I can imagine being Anna, just having, you know, what was my childhood home suddenly taken away from me. So her entire world is turned upside down. And I think for each of these daughters, you know, while they do have areas where their careers thrive after the war, Sarah returns to her work as an actress. Just a few years later, she makes this movie with Fred Astaire. Kathleen Harriman returns to her work as a reporter at Newsweek magazine in New York. Anna and her husband try to go on in the newspaper business, but really struggle. And all three of them also have you know, real tragedy that they experience after the war in very similar ways, where people who, you know, they love and who love them have suffered from the mental health crises because of their experiences during the war, which went unaddressed and unrecognized, which is, you know, just such a tragedy compared to what we know now.
Well, there are so many books written about the Roosevelts. It's unusual that I can read one that really reveals a totally different story than you expect. So we're going to end our conversation today the same way you end the book, by the way, which I loved. I'm going to just read this very short passage. This is in a letter from Sarah to her father, where she says, "Darling, darling Papa, so long as I live, I'll never forget one wonderful, wonderful journey. Over the years, the pageantry and the color of those great events may dim or get confused, but I will never forget. All this and more I will have with me forever."
She was a beautiful writer, and just, I think she kind of summed up the feelings of all of the daughters in that statement.
And they signed the last door clear. How happy my darling will be when they turn up the lights and the dark lonely nights are only a memory.
Nice.
Very good. Are we done then? Are we?
That was very good.
That was good.
So many facets in that book. It's amazing. So many things.
Yes. I mean, it was long, but it was, there was a lot of details and issues, and some of it just seems like the more things change, the more they stay the same.
So, Brad, what's up with Don being unable to unmute himself? Do you know what that's about?
Got no clue.
Yeah. All right.
Maybe he's got issues with the got it button.
Maybe so. Okay.
He said something in the beginning about changing microphone. And so from my experience, sometimes you do that. Zoom doesn't always cooperate, and you need to go into your Zoom preferences and manually tell Zoom.
You're right.
If you dial in on an actual telephone, do you get prompted for some sort of got it?
He could do that. Yes, he could do that.
Even like, yeah.
He has done that before.